From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Okay, it's probably a bit of a stretch to refer to this emerging movement of urban agriculture as homesteading. The food journalist Jennifer Cockrell King rightly points out city farm folk are not breaking sod and clearing fields. And let's be honest, for most, it's not really about subsistence. But whatever you call it, more and more people who live in cities are growing their own food. They're keeping chickens and tending beehives. Today in the program, we're talking about this movement. We want to know why people do it, how they go about it, where they're getting their information. And here's another question. Is this an enduring effort of people wanting to reimagine their connection to community and food, or is it a kind of cool, fleeting trend? We're hoping to hear from you today after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the growing movement of urban farmers or homesteaders. Neither of these names fits perfectly, by the way. It's hard to know what to call it, but you see it all over the place these days. More and more people in city environments tending chickens and beehives and using every inch of land they can for herbs and fruit trees and row after row of vegetables. The food journalist Jennifer Cockrell King is among our guests today. She's been exploring why it is more and more urbanites are investing time and energy into growing their own food. We'll be getting at some of the questions she's been asking. Are these just the usual types, the farmer's market regulars, or is it a fleeting hipster trend like the rediscovery of knitting and quilting? Or is there something more enduring going on, something that could change our approach to industrial food production and the way we think about and plan our cities? We're hoping to hear from you today, those of you who have chickens or rabbits or beehives, those of you who fret about your tomato plants and made a salad last night by simply stepping out your back door. We want to know how you're going about it, where you're getting your information, how the city is reacting or your neighbors are reacting. Maybe here's the question, what's in it for you? Join us, 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. Jennifer Cockrell King is a food journalist, the author of the book Food and the City, Urban Agriculture and the New Food Revolution. Joining us today from her home, which is in Penticton, British Columbia. Jennifer Cockrell King, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Also with us in the studio, Jonathan Krausert is with us. He's a board member of the Wasatch Community Gardens and himself an urban homesteader. Jonathan, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for being here.
Carly Gillespie is back with us. She maintains an urban homestead and is the community educator at Wasatch Community Gardens. Carly, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
We should say we're going to be posting links to all of the stories you're going to be hearing today, as well as the programs on our website, radiowest.kuer/radiowest. So, Jennifer Cockrell King, I want to start with you. I guess I want to start with that term, homesteading, urban homesteading. You've pointed out it's probably a bit of a stretch to call it homesteading, and I guess it doesn't really matter the term, but that is the term you're hearing, I guess, a bit these days.
Absolutely. It's a term that's been gaining a bit of ground in the urban agriculture community. And yeah, I mean, it's hard to equate what we're doing now in cities with what three or four generations ago went through, clearing, you know, breaking sod, clearing land, you know, trying to survive that very important first winter just based on food that you could gather, grow, or hunt or fish in your immediate environment. But nevertheless, I think it's an important step forward for people who are just simply interested in regaining that connection that we've lost so quickly with our food system.
Yeah. Jonathan, what do you call it? I guess it doesn't really matter that much.
Survival. I mean, I grew up with it in northern Wisconsin. All my family, my grandfather was in agriculture. My cousin right now is running a family farm that's been in the family since around 1858. And
wow.
So everybody in Green Bay when I was growing up in the late 60s, early 70s had a garden. It was kind of odd to not have a garden, not to have fruit trees. We were the only ones on the block that had chickens, and all the neighbors knew it because they were always been running loose. And but to me, it was just a way of having good fruits and vegetables and not having to worry about what we have to worry about today in society. With look what's in the news lately. I mean, with pesticide issues. I mean, this way at least you know where your food's coming from.
Yeah. Carly, how do you describe it? I called you a homesteader. I'm not sure. Do you think is that how you call yourself?
You know, it's so hard to call myself a homesteader when I have people like Jonathan in my life who do everything, and I feel like I fall very short of that. But definitely, like, the terminology you use to describe it is really hard, because I agree that I don't necessarily think that it is homesteading in the historical use of the word, but I also struggle to find a different term that kind of encompasses what everyone is doing, because it is more than urban agriculture or urban gardening. It's, you know, brewing beer, it's growing mushrooms, it's canning, it's preserving, it's all of these other things, and I struggle. I don't know if it's self-reliance or self-sufficiency. I've been told self-sufficiency is the Unabomber term. Self-reliance is like the hip urban homesteader term.
Right.
But again, it's all about like this terminology and how you use it, and like what can encompass what's happening, kind of like DIY ADD kind of thing. Like, it's all of these projects, and it's not just one thing. And yeah. So I struggle with it.
And I guess, Jennifer Carco King, it's not new. It seems like we sort of fell away from these things for a while, and we're just in some ways coming back to them?
Yeah, I mean, my grandparents both were born on farms in the prairies here in Canada and only moved to cities as adults. So both sets of grandparents, you know, kept up their gardening skills, their canning skills. They could, you know, bake. My grandmothers could both bake cakes just with recipes out of their memory. They had a lot of really practical, you're right, survival skills that were just common knowledge, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago. And we really got away from that because everything became very easy, very cheap, and we didn't really have the necessity. We just had all these goods available to us, and we're just, you know, it's just human nature. If it's fast and easy and cheap, we tend to go for that, and those skills get lost really quickly. But I was lucky in my family. We always pickled and canned, and my parents still keep a garden, and I learned all those skills growing up just by osmosis, which is, I'm really grateful for now. I didn't appreciate it as much at the time when I had to help out in the garden on the weekends and things like that, but it's certainly a valuable skill now.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's take a call. Jessica is with us in Tooele. Jessica, welcome.
Hi, Doug. So good to talk to you.
You too.
I love this conversation, and I'm glad there's conversation starting about it. I have chickens. I live on a quarter acre in the burbs of Tooele. I have chickens and rabbits, and I have a garden and fruit trees. And I think the debate is very interesting because what you had mentioned before was the knitting. You know, is this a fad, or is this like something that could last a long time? Well, it seems to me with a lot of urban gardeners, and there are quite a few in my neighborhood that do bees and whatnot, it's a lifestyle change. So your life starts to revolve around this. You come home, you feed your chickens, you water your garden, you can on the weekends, and then you start seeing things like, oh, well, this is made here. This is grown in Cache Valley. You start noticing local foods and produce, and so you start gravitating to those types of products. And so I think it's more of a long-term thing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we started doing it because of a lot of reasons. One great thing about our capitalist society is that we can use our dollars to make political change. And, you know, it's such an easy change for people who have normal lives.
Yeah.
So it's a great way to kind of make a big difference with just a little bit.
Jennifer Carco King, come in here on this, because this is a big question. We'll come back around to this, I think, toward the end of the show, but this is something you get at. Is this just a trend, or is
right.
there something more enduring going on?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. Once you get in tune with seasonal food and how much better it tastes, it's really hard to go back to out-of-season cardboard, you know, flavors that we do tend to get in grocery stores when we buy out-of-season, out-of-country, you know, off-continent produce and things like that. So that's one of the reasons I think that we kind of, the pendulum is swinging back in the direction of producing our own food, you know, fresh eggs, growing a garden, vine-ripened tomatoes. They're, you know, that's sort of an emblematic type product that we can grow where the difference is just so radical between, you know, one of these bullet-hard tomatoes that look like, you know, an ideal tomato in the grocery store, but are bullet-hard when we get them home and they have no flavor and they're just not, there's no pleasure in food that doesn't taste good. And we're also seeing the effects of kind of a nutrition crisis in our society. Mm. We no longer eat food that is fermented. We no longer eat, you know, like sauerkraut and kimchi and yogurts and things like that. We don't use those important biological processes in cooking anymore to keep our bodies healthy. And if we don't eat food that's seasonal and fresh, we're just missing out on so many of those minerals and nutrients and vitamins that we're starting to see our bodies kind of rebel and crave more food because, you know, we're kind of starving on the inside and looking to fill it up with cheap calories, and obviously it's not working.
Let me ask Jonathan Kresser and you, Carly, too. So I know there's a practical element here. Like, it's because you want to grow your own food. But what's the appeal? Like, what's the pleasure part?
Pleasure part? Getting eggs in the morning. You got an egg that the color of the egg is brighter than you can possibly imagine, the taste of it. Eating your vegetables fresh, picking fruit off a tree. Last year, off of a small little fruit tree we have in our park strip, we canned 18 quarts and 6 pints of nectarines off of it. Having the honey from the bees, I mean, have everything involved in it. There's something, it's almost spiritual, because it's something that's coming from, it's coming from the earth that people just are forgotten about.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just not having that connection anymore, and people have lost their connection with their food, where it's coming from. And it's critical we get back to it. I mean, we're lost souls when it comes to where our food is coming from.
Carly, what about you? The pleasure part.
I mean, obviously, the pleasure, everything that's homegrown is so much more delicious. And I think for me, like, knowing what goes into my food is really important. And you can get so wrapped up in worrying about what's going in to produce the food that you're eating and that your family is eating. And when you grow it yourself, or when you produce it yourself, you know exactly what's in it, and it takes a lot of the questions out, and it takes a lot of the worry out.
But wait, go beyond that though. Like, what I'm interested in is just what's great about it. Is it's just satisfying? You know, is it? Do you lose track of time when you're out there? I mean,
I guess
the joy part.
I guess I started because I love being outside, and growing food is a great way to kind of. I can tell myself that I don't have to go sweep and mop my floors because I have to get out and weed, right? Like, I have to go clean my chicken coop. And so it's sort of a way to give yourself chores or tasks around the house that get you outside and enjoying the weather. And whether you want to or not, you're going to go outside. And once you're out there, there's no way to not enjoy it. And being out in your garden and seeing your chickens, you know, pecking and scratching and doing what they do, it's a really fun experience for everyone. And seeing my friends bring their kids over and play with the chickens and see the food on the vine, it's a really powerful experience, I think.
Let's go back to the phones. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Vivian is with us in Salt Lake. Vivian, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Great.
Good. Well, I think I'm going to represent the moderate backyard gardener. My husband and I are pretty much both city folk coming from Toronto, Canada. I did gardening years ago, grew my own food, well, grew a few things, which certainly, I have to say, shocked my husband when he saw what a zucchini looked like when it was really growing on the vine. He thought they just came from the grocery store. But fast forward here to Salt Lake, and we live in the Canyon Rim area and just have a very small little plot. Very small. Grow just what we think we're going to eat. But I'm surrounded by people who have chicken coops and fruit trees. So we kind of do exchanges and when we can, and there's just nothing better than going outside after you've babied your little plants and are just like waiting for those tomatoes to ripen. There's nothing better than going out and picking your salad or picking peas or whatever it is you're growing that you've had a hand in, you've selected the plants, and it's just this, it's an exhilarating experience that I don't think can be duplicated. Even mint, which takes over everything, has its qualities.
Yeah. Well, it raises a big question I wanted to actually get to. Thanks very much for the call, by the way, because Jennifer Cockrell King, you talk about how, I mean, you have on one hand, you have, you know, you have Jonathan Krauser on one end of the spectrum. Like he is all in. And then maybe you have Vivian on the, maybe the other end, which is she wants to be, she doesn't necessarily have all the time. She's sort of, I think moderate was the way she put it. And that's sort of the continuum, right? Because you talk about in some ways we're probably going to end up in some middle ground, somewhere in between those ideas. And that's okay.
Well, Vivian brought up a really good, important point about what she's doing. So she doesn't feel like she's doing a lot, but it's already getting her interacting with her neighbors.
Yeah.
So there's already this little neighborhood trade system that's happening. And, you know, she feels good about what she's doing, and she's unplugging from, you know, we lead these very digitally dominated lives. And what I love about gardening is just being able to unplug and go into analog mode for a little while. And there's something really soothing about that. So, you know, she's already de-stressing. She's getting out there. We're connecting again with our neighbors. And I think this is one really important aspect of urban food production that tends to get overlooked. I'm sure it's the same in every North American city. There was a time when you just didn't interact with your neighbors anymore. In the 80s and the 90s and early 2000s, we were in our cars, going to work, going to the gym, picking up, you know, food at the restaurant or fast food outlet, bringing it home and sitting in front of the TV and eating it. And that was sort of the cycle of our day. And we've kind of snapped out of it and realized that there are, you know, we don't want to be isolated. We want to be in communities. We want to be interacting with our fellow humans and our fellow chickens and our fellow bees. So we're kind of reawakening that primal necessity for community, and that's what I love. Plants really can bring people together that might not have a lot in common on the surface, but we all eat. And we all can appreciate good food or better food than what we have access to. And certainly in cities where we have so much inbound immigration and, you know, we've got people coming from all over the place, there's one common denominator that we can connect on in a community level, no matter whether you were born in Salt Lake City or not, and that's over food.
Yeah. Carly, it seems that not everyone is going to have the inclination to, you know, collect their own rainwater and pull up their parking strip for oregano or whatever. You know, I mean, so you can, but you can find a, like I said, a middle ground, right? It's okay.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, if going into whatever I'm doing, whether I want to call it urban homesteading or not, if I saw that, like, Jonathan's an urban homesteader and that's what you have to do to be a homesteader, I wouldn't have done it because it just seems so overwhelming and really unattainable. I mean, Jonathan's doing such amazing things. And I just bought a house last summer. And if I thought that I had to be gathering rainwater and growing every inch of my property and having chickens and keeping bees and everything all at once, I would be so overwhelmed and really wouldn't get into it. And so I think it is a kind of a step-by-step process. And you can stop at any point. Maybe you decide just to grow a vegetable garden, or maybe you plant some fruit trees, or maybe you go urban foraging with your friends and go to your kitchen and can that food. And especially in my line of work, where I do a lot of education around these sorts of skills, I see people who are really interested in composting with worms, and they have no other interest in doing anything else. And I really don't want to talk about it in a way that it limits people who don't have property or don't own their own home.
Yeah.
Like, you can be fairly self-reliant, living in an apartment by having a vermicompost bin, having a garden at a community garden plot, supporting your local farmers. And so I think that we kind of have to take all of those things into consideration, especially in the urban aspect, because not everyone does have a chunk of property where they can grow all of this stuff and keep their own chickens. So I think that there's, yes, a very large range of ways you can get involved.
801-585 West, the number to join the conversation. Russell in Farmington, call back. I wanted to get your perspective, if you can. Let's take another call from Rodney, this time in North Ogden. Rodney, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I was listening to when she first came on, and, you know, the big question is, why do we do this, and what's the motivation? And when she said DIY, ADD, that just kind of just rang a bell with me. It's, you know, I got hooked on this the first time I picked one of my own tomatoes off my garden and just took a bite of it. It was like nothing I've ever had in my life before. And every year I just, you know, whether I want to or not, because I tell myself every year, okay, I'm done. Every year, whether I want to or not, I find a project that takes my whole spring up. You know, I've added bees. The next year I did a full greenhouse. The year after that I redid the greenhouse. This year I'm doing what would be like intensive mulching, where I turn my whole backyard into like deep mulching. Some people call it lasagna or back to Eden, just something like that. And it's just, it's almost like in all these things, I just enjoy them so much and in what I get out of them. So that's kind of my take. And it's almost like I'm just in an urban environment. I'm just trying to see what I can get away with without making the city or the neighbors upset.
Yeah. Well, glad you called. Thanks very much. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Ronald writes on Facebook, he says, the fact is, those of us who have been through the shift from family farming to feedlot and agribusiness farming over the last 60 years know that industrial agriculture is facing too many variables to be considered predictable or sustainable. Ronald writes, we as families lost control of that one. It's been a losing contest over the basic necessities of life to any community, regardless of scale. He says it's encouraging to see the growth of urban small plot and intensive community gardening programs. These folks are a spark of hope. Terry Lynn writes, my husband and I keep bees. We also keep a relatively large garden. We do it, I think, because it's good for the environment, our health, and out of general love of nature. I do think that the local government could do more to promote urban sustainable living practices. And that's, Terry Lynn, where we're headed after a break, the question of governments and neighbors. 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Jennifer Cockrell King is with us, a food journalist. Also Jonathan Krausert and Carly Gillespie, urban farmers or homesteaders or whatever it is we're calling them. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're asking, what is the deal with all of these people wanting to raise chickens and keep bees and grow heirloom potatoes in the backyard? We're talking about this emerging movement of urban gardeners and farmers. It seems to be more than just a trend. It's all about self-reliance and the pleasure of the experience. It's also about preserving and relearning the skills of older generations. Some dabble, some are all in. Wherever you are, we're hoping to hear from you. 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Jennifer Cockrell King is with us, a food journalist, author of the book Food and the City, Urban Agriculture and the New Food Revolution. We also have with us Jonathan Krausert. He's an urban homesteader, a board member of Wasatch Community Gardens. And Carly Gillespie's with us, community educator for the Wasatch Community Garden, and she keeps an urban homestead herself. So let me read an email from John, and then I want to get to Mike, who's on the line from Salt Lake City. John writes, I converted my entire front yard into a garden. A single neighbor, not even on my street, complained to the city. A city inspector made it her mission to make me stop. The court finally ruled in my favor. I have neighbors who have chickens. Last year I grew 300 plus pounds of tomatoes, 125 pounds of cucumbers. In addition, it's one activity that helps keep me sane. I call myself an urban farmer. Okay, so it's raising the question of how the city gets involved, how much indulgence they give you, how much a neighbor does. Let me take another call from Mike so we can get into this a little bit more. Mike's in Salt Lake. Mike, welcome.
Thank you. You know, I just wanted to talk a little bit about Salt Lake City's fairly progressive laws. They actually have laws on the books about keeping chickens and about keeping bees and about urban gardening. And because of those, I'm able to have chickens and beehives in the heart of Sugar House.
Yeah.
And I know other people who can do the same in the avenues.
But Jonathan Krauser, you're pretty pleased with the way the government's letting this play out.
And actually, being part of Wasatch Community Gardens, I attended a lot of those meetings. And the city, I got to commend them. The council is very progressive on it. They've changed the ordinances years ago on having grass in your park strip. Chickens, they liberalized the laws on them, on bees, on greenhouses, on hoop houses, on having gardens in your front yard. The Salt Lake City is definitely on the cutting edge when it comes to urban homesteading. And there's a lot of other municipalities around Utah could learn from Salt Lake City and around the country learn.
Jennifer, it seems like that we started out with people just governments early on in our history as a country, just expecting that people would do this in their environments, right? And then at some point, we created these laws that said you have to have grass in your park strip or that you shouldn't have. Are we coming full circle in some way in terms of these laws?
I certainly hope so. I mean, that's exactly right. We used to produce a tremendous amount of food in cities. When cities would spring up, people would, try to be self-sufficient because we didn't have access to this global industrial food system that we have access to now. So we used to garden out of necessity, just to have fresh food that available to us, and that's why we knew how to can and pickle and preserve and smoke and salt and do all these things that keep food throughout the year. And in the First World War, during the Depression, in the Second World War, we used to produce a tremendous amount of food in cities. There was the whole Victory Gardens movement, and at the height of that, in the early 40s, the U.S. was producing 40% of the fresh food and vegetables consumed in the U.S. was produced on these Victory Gardens. So we used to do a lot of that, but then we got into this idea of modernization of our cities and suburbanization, and we had all of a sudden people had access to cars and could drive to shopping centers in the 50s, and we developed suburbs, and there was a real urban planning movement toward conformity and uniformity, and growing food and producing food was really pushed out, and bylaws were rewritten to discourage this and make it illegal in a lot of cities. And so it's nice to hear that Salt Lake is very progressive. That's certainly not the case everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's really just a question of bringing city councilors back up to speed with the movement. It's coming from a grassroots place, and people want to be self-reliant again. And so now it's kind of this grassroots movement that's having to push our elected officials into places where they're not always comfortable, only because they don't know much about urban beekeeping. So there are a lot of misconceptions. But I love to tell people about Paris and London. I mean, there are thousands of urban beekeepers in downtown London, and similarly with Paris. And, nothing untoward happens to people walking down the street just because you've got beehives on rooftop balconies and things like that in Paris. So we are moving back towards it. It's a frustrating, slow process for those of us in communities that want to, convert our front yard into a vegetable garden. And in some places, that's just simply against the bylaws because we decided at one point that growing food in cities was not modern. It was it wasn't progressive, and so we wanted people to modernize and get with the program with, you know, their cars going to big shopping malls and things like that. And we did a pretty good job of eradicating urban agriculture for a number of years.
Yeah.
But it's back now, and you know, it's just a question of putting the appropriate amount of pressure on your municipal officials so that they get the bylaws changed again in favor of being able to do what people want to do. Because we hold the political power in cities. We just forget about that.
Yeah. Carly Gillespie, what about your neighbors? How do you, what guidance do you give people who have neighbors who are kind of looking askance at the fact that you want to tear up your parking strip or the, how filthy are these chickens going to be and they're close to my kids? I mean, surely you get that, right?
You get that. Luckily, like Jonathan said, in Salt Lake, we do have fairly progressive ordinances in place, so we are protected. As long as you fall within the parameters of the ordinance, you can have neighbors that can complain, but there's nothing that they can do to have your chickens taken away or your garden taken away because the city has protected us. That being said, outside of Salt Lake City proper, once you get out into Salt Lake County and the other counties, there's other municipalities that have different kinds of laws around it and varying degrees of leniency.
Yeah.
So I know that I've really noticed out in the different municipalities, it seems like the places that more recently got the farmland out are much more strict about keeping it out.
Yeah.
So like the newer suburban developments have a lot of issues with it. But you know,
Like Kaysville? Like Kaysville, for example, I mean, they're stripping out a lot of those onion fields. I mean, mm-hmm. That was all agriculture.
Right.
And so now they're like, what are you doing? We got rid of that stuff. Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah. And West Valley or Riverton, those places that, you know, as I was growing up, were still very much farmland and now have very cookie cutter kind of developments going in, have made stricter laws or laws that are slightly convoluted or vague, so instead of protecting you, they say, oh, you might be able to have them, or you can't have them at all. I think Murray's fighting a big chicken fight right now to try to get chickens allowed in their area. Mm. But, you know, I think the more education we can do as a community and the more you can talk to your neighbors and try to be a good neighbor and say, I'm thinking about getting chickens. How do you feel about this? I would love to share my eggs with you. I'd love to have your kids
That's
over.
That's the trick. That's the trick,
Bribing
right?
is always a good idea.
That's the best way. I've never seen a neighbor yet turn down fresh eggs or honey. Yes, they've turned down zucchini, but not fresh eggs or honey.
801-585 West, the number to join us. Let's go back to the phones. Katie is with us in Kaysville. Hi, Katie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a huge NPR nerd. This is a thrill.
Good. Go ahead.
I grew up in Northern California, kind of near to the place where the Donner Party passed by. So it never really escaped my attention how my life might be different if I had been a young pioneering woman. And in the last couple of years, I've picked up quilting because I remember reading stories about young independent women during the Alaskan Gold Rush literally hiking to Alaska with their sewing machines on their back to make a living. And the sub-point to that is that anywhere you go in the United States, if you have an interest in quilting, there's a local quilting guild, and you can go and gab and learn from the silliest, most creative old ladies you've ever met in your life. And they're not necessarily all of an older generation, but it's a great way to connect, not just like with what your past might have been, but what your future might be through these other women. And it's a great hobby, a great way to pass time after the sun is set and you can't work in your garden anymore.
Yeah. Jennifer Carkle King, isn't that part of it? This idea of connecting with people of a different generation who have all kinds of stories and all kinds of wisdom, that whole connection is a big part of this, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really positive move in our society that we're starting to look up to generations with their experience and their skills as opposed to looking down on, you know, the generations that came before us as being backwards or somehow not as sophisticated. So this has just been the greatest cultural, social shift that I've noticed. And one of the great things about gardening is if you talk to anyone of a certain generation, they have a lot of gardening skill. I get a lot of questions from people about how to start a garden or how to learn to, you know, plant seeds or grow just a bit of food. And I always suggest that they join a community garden and buddy up with somebody there that looks like they know what they're doing. And, you know, people in the retiree generation have time on their hands and they're very willing to help, you know, younger people get up to speed with gardening skills and growing skills. And, you know, people of the younger generation can do a little bit of the harder labor work, and it all works out really well. It's just a nice way to actually bridge this big gap that we've developed between the generations.
Yeah. Jonathan and Carly, you two, do you guys go to the old timers to get, you know, keys about when to get the peas in and stuff like that?
Jonathan is my old timer.
Now I've become one of the old timers, but at one time, that's where my grandparents came in. They were great mentors to me. I mean, I learned how to make soap, how to make wine, to garden, to take care of chickens, to take care of fruit trees. Everything I came from them, and there wasn't a lost contact. We have this lost contact now, and a good point is community gardening helps with that. I mean, Carly oversees a great amount, all these great workshops we have. We're going to have over 60 of them this year. Mm. Another thing, you can be part of a community garden. I also have a plot at one of the community gardens. And you're interacting with other gardeners. You're learning their techniques. I mean, you can teach an old dog new tricks like myself. And it's great for interacting with the community. And that's what we have, a loss of community. And Wasatch is a really good place for that. I mean, Carly could probably talk a lot more about the aspects of our workshops that we have, which are really helpful for gardeners.
And, you know, I mean, coming from the place where I did, where I was a child of the 80s, I grew up on processed foods. I didn't necessarily know where my food came from. It was really important for me when I came back to Salt Lake, kind of connecting with people like Jonathan or another friend of mine, Danny, who, like, have these skills that I wouldn't get anywhere else. Like, right. My mother doesn't necessarily know how to organic garden until I taught her how. And I think that's another kind of way to talk about it, mm-hmm. is that it's not just the old-timers teaching the younger folks stuff. I have a lot of workshops that are taught by very young farmers that are 25, 30 years old, and I have people that are coming to these workshops that are 50, 60 years old. And so I think the information exchange goes both direction, and that is the beauty of community gardening or gardening in general in your neighborhood, because no matter what, people start talking. If you're growing a garden in your front yard, people will come up to you and start that conversation, and they'll be of all ages and different backgrounds, and they won't only ask you what you're doing, but they will tell you what they're doing. They'll tell you how they do it. They tell you what they're growing. They'll tell you what they're eating, and it's a great conversation starter, and it's a really great way to exchange and interact with people you wouldn't normally be interacting with.
We are losing our last generation of farmers as well in North America. You know, we're down to 1.5 to 2% of the population involved in primary agricultural activities, and the age of the average farmer in North America is in their 60s. Yeah. So we are facing a huge knowledge gap that's going to happen when this group of farmers, even though it's a very thin wedge right now, decides to retire. So this knowledge transfer that's happening that may seem kind of quaint or inconsequential or hipster or whatever it is actually such an important thread that we need to keep connected, because that knowledge, once it's gone, it's just going to be so much harder. You can't learn to bake bread from a cookbook, just like you can't really learn to garden from a television show or a textbook. So it really is that apprenticeship model that needs to happen. And if we don't have any more mentors, no matter how much enthusiasm toward growing food we have, there won't be any teachers left.
Here's an email from Melody, who writes, I started raising chickens 3 years ago. They are free range in the coop at night, and they make us all laugh a dozen times a day. They are so funny. They run all of the time like cartoon dinosaurs. They hop up on our chairs, preen beside us. The downside, chickens stop laying after about 3 years. They can live up to 15 years. We just got 3 new chicks, so we'll have eggs next year. But what to do with our charming girls, Buffy, Scarlet, and Chicken Little Rock? They'll live out their lives with us. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Jennifer Cockrell-King is with us, along with Jonathan Krausert and Carly Gillespie. And we'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about this emerging movement of urban gardeners and farmers, and we invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go back to the phones. Let's see. Christy is with us in Park City. Christy, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have children, and I felt that it was important to have them understand where their food comes from, because we have been such a throwaway society where, you know, we don't finish and, you know, food comes and goes at mass quantities, and just wanted them to understand how hard it is and to appreciate the food that they eat. And also for the fact that I work a very high-stress job, and when I come home, you know, when you do that kind of gardening or raising the animals, it takes you back to a simplistic way of life, and it becomes more simple and relaxing,
yeah.
Almost.
Good for you. Congratulations. Glad you called. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Alex is with us in Lehigh. Alex, welcome to the program.
Hello, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
I'm a professional gardener, and I've seen a lot of reasons why people want to go back to the earth. And one of them I really notice is soldiers, when they get back from deployment, are really prone to doing it because, you know, it brings a stability and a sustainability to take care of yourself back to their lives that they couldn't have eating MREs in Afghanistan or Iraq.
Wow. Jonathan, what do you think about that? That's so, what a...
Well, this day and age, what we have one out of eight people in this country are on food stamps. We don't know how our economy goes from day to day. Growing some of your own food actually brings you a sense of security. I mean, by doing that, it gives you some type of control.
Control is the word, right?
Some kind of control in our lives where we've become a society of one big machine. And the machine is controlling things. And sometimes we feel helpless, and this is one way of not feeling helpless.
Yeah. Alex, thanks a lot. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. Jennifer is with us in Eagle Mountain. Jennifer, hi.
Hi. I've just been listening to the whole conversation, and the whole time I'm just nodding my head saying, yes, yes, that's why I garden, and that's why I do it. And I just love the comments that were made about the generation gaps being brought together. That's what I love about gardening right now is I garden with my father, and now he's gardening with my children, and it's wonderful to see that exchange and that bond that gets to grow through gardening. And not only there, but at the dinner table, we bring in the food, and we cook it. We create wonderful meals. It brings us all together at the table, excited to eat what we've grown, and it's scratch. It's from scratch. You know, we're back in the kitchen working 2 hours to create a meal, whereas one used to just pop in something in the oven, it's ready in 30 minutes, and you're not really sure what's in it, but it tastes good, but this is so much better.
Yeah.
Gardening is just much more enriching, not only in your lives, but in your diet, in your health, and within your family.
Jennifer, thanks so much. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. What do you guys think?
Food is a celebration of life, and gardening's part of that, and yeah, across generations, across age groups, across religious groups, across every group you can come across, gardening brings people together.
Yeah, which is, I think, something that Jason wants to talk about in Ogden. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Doug. What I found is with the urban garden I have and with my friends, it's actually kind of united us politically. So my friends that are real extreme left-leaning and my other friends that are real right-leaning, when we sit down around the table, it's about our gardens, it's about our bees and our chickens that we have. And it's actually, interestingly enough, it's not, you know, are we Republican or are we Democrat? It's, okay, how can we get Ogden City to allow us to be able to expand what we do and what we love?
Mm. I love that idea, too, right? I mean, a garden bringing you together politically.
Yeah, it definitely
does. Because isn't that an issue right now? I mean, so separate.
Right.
And why not come together to talk about, you know, your beans.
Absolutely. And I mean, everyone can get together around food, right? Like, we all need to eat. We all want to have good food. And we a lot of us want to produce it ourselves. And so I think it is something that can cross those political boundaries and something we can all get behind.
Jason,
there's a reason that large celebrations and healing ceremonies happen around feasting and food. It's just so restorative. And it's really hard to be mad at somebody that you're sitting across the table from sharing food with. You tend to find common ground, pardon the expression. But there is something just so basic and primal about sharing something with somebody else. And I think what we're getting at in a lot of these discussions is it's getting us out of our own selves. We're so self-involved. We're so concerned with ourselves and personal development and our own, you know, personal growth. It's really refreshing to just nurture something. You know, we were talking about the Army, people coming back from the war, and they just need something to do that gets them out of their head every once in a while, and to nurture something into a positive force that has a real physical manifestation that they can watch. And that's the thing about growing food. It's, you know, I get a lot of questions about, well, can we be self-sufficient with an urban garden? But to me, that's not really the end game. The end game are these sort of softer benefits that we get that are much more important.
801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Back to the phones. Paul with us in Centerville, Utah. Paul, welcome.
Hey, thanks, Doug. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Today, I concur with everything that's been said on the program, and I just want to input my 2 cents worth. When I married my wife several years ago, her father had a half-acre garden in the back of his house and had it for years. And as his health started to deteriorate, well, I took over more of it until the last 3 years. I've done it completely because he's now 92 and he can't get out in the garden. And I'll tell you, I was instrumental in having part of that garden that was turned into pasture because it seemed like too much work and not a lot of people wanted to participate in it. And I convinced my father-in-law that I thought because of economic times, and we're talking like 2007, 2008, I could see what was happening. And we took that pasture and reconverted it back to a garden. And since that time, I've had my sister who is married and another sister who is married, then their families have reached a point where one was unemployed, one was discharged from the Army and wondering what to do. And we had a food reserve that we could draw on. And that, to me, is worth more than having money in the bank or gold or silver, whatever else. If you've got food that you can sustain yourself, that's worth more than anything that I can think of as far as subsistence.
Yeah. Paul, thanks.
Peace of mind.
Yeah. Keeps coming back to that, doesn't it? I mean,
very much so.
Yeah. You know, an email from Marco who writes about his experience moving from Utah. He was in Washington, D.C. for a year. They rented a townhouse, he says, just a few blocks from the Capitol. Cleaned up the tiny weed-filled front yard, planted a pocket garden with chard and basil and tomatoes, which we enjoyed all summer, he says. When our lease was up in the fall, we proudly turned the garden over to the landlord. We were surprised and sad when he ripped up the vegetables and charged us the expenses against our damaged deposit, claiming tomatoes just attract rats and vagrants. I guess, and he says, not everyone gets the memo. I guess, Jennifer Carkle King, there's still a few obstacles to overcome, right?
Well, you say a term like urban agriculture is a bit problematic because agriculture has this connotation of tractors and pesticides and herbicides and monocropping. So, you know, It's usually people that don't have a visual in their mind that supersedes what exists in their minds as a large commercial farm. So that's where a lot of the resistance comes from. I think as we normalize food growing in cities, we'll get people who are afraid of it or who disagree with it or who have concerns. Those concerns will be met and they'll just be on board, and soon we'll be producing a load of food in cities. We have a lot of space available in our cities, and it's very expensive for our municipal governments to mow those lawns and trim those ornamental trees.
Jonathan and Carly, let me ask you this finally. So if you want to do this, where do you start? Just just take the step, right? Don't worry about going too big. Just be simple, right?
That's how I started out. When I bought the house, I tore out grass a little bit at a time, added a tree a little bit at a time. We're up to 9 fruit trees. We're pretty much maxed out. So you just do a little bit at a time, and sooner or later, you'll have it all the way you want it.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah, just go for it. Start small. Don't try to do everything all at once. You'll get overwhelmed and not be as successful as you want to be, and that sets yourself up for failure. So start small, grow some food, and enjoy it.
Jennifer, a final question. We've got about 30 seconds left. In your book, you wonder where the initial sparks of this revolution are going to take us. You know, is there enough critical mass and commitment to continue all of this? What do you think now?
I think so. I've really seen the trend move into the mainstream, which to me is a good thing. And once people get the flavor palette of fresh, good, nutritious food established with them, it's really hard to go back to eating cardboard. So I think we'll just let our taste buds lead the way.
Yeah. Jennifer Cockrell King, she's a food journalist, author of the book Food in the City, Urban Agriculture and the New Food Revolution, joined us today by phone from her home in Penticton, British Columbia. Jennifer Cockrell King, well, thanks very much for being with us.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you.
Jonathan Krausert and Carly Gillespie, thanks to both of you, by the way, for being with us also, and good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We should mention that we're going to have links to the stories and to the Wasatch Community Gardens, all of that information on our website. Radio West is a production of KUER News, technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our thanks to Taylor Almond, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.